Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Andrew, are you out from behind your sofa yet?
Yes, we've had a lot of pretty adverse comments.
Well, I'd say 50-50, but we've certainly received a little bit of a kicking from some people over our last episode. That is true. That's true.
Well, I keep saying time will tell. Who knows what stories will emerge?
Well, I never really I don't want to be defensive. I've worked in. You've received and given notes as a writer. I've done the same, and as a TV person, you know. It's always worth listening to what people say about your work. I mean, I feel that Valentine gave a very good answer and a very reasonable answer to all the things we put to him. But I guess we did put to him some fairly gossipy stuff.
Yeah, but in some ways that's you've got to press, and we had to sort of raise these issues because they're in the press at the moment in a big way. I mean, Tom Quinn talking on 60 Minutes in Australia saying that actually the news about the king's health was meant to be a diversion from this bigger problem, which he puts down to basically Kate being exhausted and wanting time out.
Well, it is interesting. It has made me think a little bit about gossip. I mean, it's something we deal with in both of our professions, you know, and throughout our lives. A lot of the stories that we now know to be true started their lives as gossip, you know, gossip about Lord Mountbatten's sex life.
Yes,
gossip about what Prince Andrew was doing on his trips, who he was hanging out with, his interest in young women, very young women. You know, all that began.
Yeah, I think people can be a little po-faced, you know, on these things. It does often, as you say, lead to something, but there's no reason why one shouldn't air them, and they can always be shot down. I don't think in our program we were claiming they were true. We were just putting these scenarios to Valentine, who shot them down.
Yeah, most of them he did. No, I remember, you know, the Diana Charles story. There was, for many years, rumours are reaching journalists about unhappiness in the marriage, about the fact that he spent a lot of time with his ex-girlfriend called Camilla Parker Bowles. She was seen often in the company of this man, James Hewitt. What's going on? Oh, it's just gossip. It's just malicious gossip being spread. And even after Morton's book, which Diana kind of semi-publicly endorsed, I remember reading articles in the papers by the likes of, well, let's say, Penny Juner, friends of Charles, saying, how dare you spread these? It's just nonsense. It's just not true. It's malicious. It's paranoia. Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, also, you've got to remember, a lot of royal writers are very much in hock to the palace and will do their bidding. And so they will come out and either discredit people or discredit stories to support whatever the palace curation of the story is going to be.
Nobody ever accused you of that.
No, they haven't done that. But I think it's a fascinating story because it has constitutional implications. You know, if William is going to have to step up sooner than everyone expected, then the state of his marriage is very important.
Indeed it is. All right, well, shall we move on? Because we have other matters to discuss. Actually, before we do, I want to just do my comments thing, because it was actually quite interesting. It's quite actually people engage a little bit critical, but say things like, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? You know, we have quite a few people who actually kind of really like the fact that we do struggle with these issues kind of publicly. Davina Wilson had interesting things to say. Tina Jesse, I think she's mentioned her name before. Teacup2492. We had a long back and forth in the comments, which I enjoyed, about the sort of rights and wrongs of royal reporting. So I think, you know, kudos to our listeners. We've got a good, engaged, and intelligent crowd out there.
Yes, no, some very good comments coming kissy, back, kissy. Which is really helpful.
Kissing up to the fan base.
Yeah, well, no, keep going. We hope it's going to grow, and you know, more people will come. I mean, these stories do tend to attract new subscribers in a way some of our more investigative book subjects don't.
Yes, they do, and we like to do a mix, as we keep saying. All right, on to Blood. Who are we talking to today?
Well, we're talking to Jason Evans, who's run something called Factor VIII. He's a long-time campaigner for infected blood, which his father suffered from and I think died from. And it's a big story in Britain, and it's like the post office scandal. They've been fighting for compensation for years. There's been a big cover-up, and I think people were still being given infected blood, haemophiliacs and others, when people knew about the risks. So it's a pretty shocking story.
Yes, I think it affected people all around the world, actually. I think most countries had a bad experience of this, but they sort of reacted in different ways. And surprise, surprise, it seems that in Britain, the feet were being dragged more slowly at the official level than in most other places, which is kind of typical, I'm afraid.
Yeah. So, no, I think it's I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
All right. Well, let's do that then. And then maybe at the end of the show, we can talk about all the delightful things, definitely not controversial things, coming up soon.
Yep.
Let's do that. Here we go. Jason, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
It's a hell of a story you have to tell, and it's one that people should know about, but by and large don't, even now.
That's right. That's right. I think, the infected blood scandal is perhaps not just the greatest untold injustice, as Andy Burnham put it, but also perhaps the most misunderstood in many ways that we'll probably come on to.
And I mean, I think what's so shocking is it's been going on for so long and it hasn't really been sorted out even yet.
No, I mean, people have been dying campaigning and their bereaved families have been campaigning on this for 30 plus years. I mean, in my own personal circumstance, my father, who was impacted by this, who was infected with hepatitis C and HIV through the infected blood product Factor VIII. He died in 93 when I was 4 years old. He died campaigning. And I'm still campaigning now at the age of 34. So this has gone on for a very long time. And certainly there are many other people that have been campaigning for far longer than I have.
Could you tell us what Factor VIII is? I know this is absolutely kind of basic stuff to you, but I do think a lot of people, especially outside Britain, won't know. So the kind of building blocks of this disaster, what happened?
Yes, I mean, if we could have the sort of, because most of our listeners won't know about the infected blood scandal. So really, can you just take us through the whole story right from the very beginning?
Sure. I mean, at the heart of this scandal, and this is where there's often a lot of misunderstanding, is a blood product, not a blood transfusion, but a blood product called Factor VIII. So this is a product which comes onto the market really in a big way in the early 1970s. And it's made by mixing together the plasma donations of tens of thousands of people. Now, in the case of the American manufacturers, often those the plasma they were collecting, they were paying for it, which was not happening here in the UK on the NHS. The plasma brokers were buying in plasma from South America, from Africa, from Haiti, from wherever they could get it, basically. And obviously, in a lot of those locations, the regulation was much less than it would be in this country, for example. And also that system of paid plasma means that you naturally attract people who are desperate for money, which often the plasma centers we've seen in the evidence would purposefully be set up in Skid Row locations, as they were referred to at the time, where you've got high incidence of sex working, IV, drug abuse, etc. And so they're taking, the pharmaceutical companies are gathering all this high-risk plasma and they're mixing it all together. The problem being that you only need one of those donations to be infected with hepatitis, HIV, and everything's infected at that point. And they're then freeze-drying that plasma down into a white powder, which goes into a bottle. And thousands of those bottles through the 70s and 80s are shipped into the UK. You dissolve the powder into water. That's how the treatment works. And then people would infuse this stuff into their bodies, infecting themselves with hepatitis C, HIV, hepatitis B, because that's just the nature of what happens. And, you know, I won't go into the full kind of backstory now, but it's very shocking, I guess, to know that these products came to market in the early 70s, but 20 years prior, in 1953, the World Health Organization had published a clear warning saying that plasma products like Factor VIII should not be made from more than 10 donations. And they said definitely never more than 20, but ideally not more than 10, specifically because of the risk of hepatitis. Yet 20 years later, it seems because of the profit motive, that's exactly what Factor VIII manufacturers did, going into tens of thousands of donations, just breaching that warning completely.
So was your father being treated in this way? What was the Factor VIII meant to help with?
I mean, who were the people who were being given these blood transfusions? Were they particular sorts of patients?
So the reason the product is called Factor VIII, the actual full title of it is Factor VIII Concentrate. And the reason it's called Factor VIII is that's the name of the protein in your blood that in a person with a blood clotting disorder called hemophilia is either much less or missing. And so my father had hemophilia, and by and large, almost everybody that used these products had hemophilia. And so what hemophilia means is that you are, the main problem with hemophilia is spontaneous bleeding into big joints, so knees, shoulders, ankles, etc. There is a misconception, you know, a big misconception about hemophilia, that if you get a paper cut, you're going to bleed to death, and unless you get, you know, that's really not the case. The main problem is bleeding into the big joints. Now, before that Factor Concentrate product came onto the market, there was a previous treatment, and that was called cryoprecipitate, or cryo for short. And that product was as effective as Factor VIII Concentrate, but the differences were, one, it was not a commercial product. It was similar to a blood transfusion, except it was just the part that you need of the blood, which was thawed down. Now, that product did have to be kept frozen, which was a disadvantage. For example, to travel with a product that needs to be kept frozen is quite difficult, whereas Factor VIII, people with hemophilia could travel more easily with that product. And also, the amount of time it took to use cryoprecipitate was a bit longer than the Factor VIII Concentrate, because before you could use it, you had to defrost it, which I know now for a medicinal product seems a little bit strange, but that's the way it was. And so that was not a commercial product. It was less convenient. That's the main thing. It was less convenient. And so the big selling point for the pharma companies with Factor VIII Concentrate was, this is going to be a much more convenient product. You don't have to keep it frozen. You can travel with it. It's quicker to use, you know. And so not knowing the risks, when this product came out on the market to the haemophilia community, it seemed great. You know, this is going to improve the way our treatment works. This is going to be a good thing. And then steadily, you know, as time went on, it would turn out that actually not only would it not improve their lives, it would completely destroy and for many end their lives.
Did your father know? I mean, did anybody know? Sorry, there was this background in America. You mentioned this report in the 50s. Did anybody at that time, 70s and 80s, did they know that they were taking a risk with their own health, or were they just blithely unaware of this stuff?
Well, I was going to say, how quickly did people realize that this was dangerous, and how quickly was something done about it?
So the answer is different, I think, from the different interests and perspectives. So certainly we've seen through the evidence of the infective blood inquiry that's been going on since 2017 and is due to publish its final report in May of this year, of which I've been at virtually every hearing. We've seen through the evidence that certainly within the pharmaceutical companies, they knew that the risks of hepatitis were there. You know, we're talking about going back to the 40s and 50s, way before you know, this product even came on the market. They know that by mixing plasma products together, it's a bad idea. And it was for that reason, just before I come on to some of the other warnings and things that were known, that going back to 1945, a similar blood product called albumin, which is used to treat burns and has other uses, that was heated, subject to a heat treatment, which kills hepatitis, and it would turn out HIV as well. But that was being done actually in 1945, and it was being done specifically to kill hepatitis. So this stuff was all known much earlier, and the means to make the product safe were known about much earlier. The reason why, because that's the natural next question that comes, well, why, if they knew about the risk, if they knew the solution to the risk, why didn't they do it in the 70s as the product comes on the market? And the answer is, when you heat a plasma product to kill viruses, you need what's called a stabilizer, which is basically a chemical additive, which is going to allow the product to be heated to kill the virus, but without damaging the bit that you want, which in this case is the factor VIII protein. And in order to find that stabilizer, you need to invest a not inconsiderable amount into R&D, research and development. Now, eventually, that happened in the 80s when it became clear to the companies that actually with HIV, we're going to kill our entire customer base if we don't do this. Once they actually began to do it, within a couple of years, it had been done. And they could have done that before the product was ever released on the market. So to come back to who knew what and when, so risks of viral transmission are known before the product's ever on the market. Certainly, senior medical professionals in this country were aware of the risks of plasma products before the products were introduced. And certainly, the regulatory authorities at the time, that was the Committee on Safety of Medicines, they were also aware. But the justification, if you want to put it that way, was that, well, these products are in advance and, you know, hepatitis might be bad for some people, but, you know, you just see when you look at the documents, there's this kind of turning of a blind eye, I guess, is the best.
Well, they were balancing risks in their mind. They were balancing risks, I guess.
So these are the doctors rather than the pharmaceutical companies.
So you see it different in different ways in different places. So the pharmaceutical companies, personally, I haven't seen much balancing of risk going on. You do see some of that in terms of, for example, there was an organization called the UKHCDO in this country, which was the United Kingdom Haemophilia Centre Directors Organization. So these are the senior haemophilia treaters in the country that kind of make not formal legal guidelines, but general policies that they think should be followed for haemophilia treaters. And all the way along with this, that there seems to have been, rather than what you might expect now with what people call the precautionary principle, which is if we see, a significant risk or the potential for risk, we should err on the side of caution and safety. What you tend to see instead throughout the documents is this approach of wanting absolute conclusive proof before taking any decisions. And so, for example, we saw that with when HIV emerged in the 80s, and the vast majority of the American product was infected with HIV at that time. A minority of the UK product did become infected as well. But what you saw was in 82, it's clear that AIDS is being caused by a transmissible virus. That's the leading theory. And in 1983, it's accepted by virtually everybody. In 1984, there's no doubt this just is the case. And it, particularly because in April of 84, the tests for the virus begin to be looked at and coming on stream into late 84. And all this time, all the years I'm mentioning and flying through, this product is still on the market, still infecting people all the way into the back end of 1985, in fact. And the whole way through that period I've just talked about, the pharmaceutical company's approach and the approach of the state was, until we have absolute proof that this product is infecting a big enough number of people for it to be important, let's say, we're not going to change anything. We're not going to rock the boat, despite the knowledge of that risk, which now seems crazy. But that was the approach that was taken. One of the things that's come up time and time again at the inquiry is, for example, you had in the back end of 83, in November of 1983, Ken Clark saying in response to parliamentary questions that would be
there's a British health minister at the time.
Yes, at the time, Ken Clark's British health minister, and he's telling Parliament there is no conclusive proof that AIDS is being transmitted through blood products, which is an interesting way to word a line when, in the Department of Health's own documents, they're saying it almost certainly is. And so what we see time and time again is what's being discussed privately by officials and ministers behind the scenes does not match what is being said publicly.
Oh. And is this the period, is this when your father was catching the diseases that killed him?
Yes. So my dad first tested positive for HIV in November 1984. He wasn't told about that until mid-1985, which is another common thread in this whole scandal, the inquiry evidence, is people not only being infected, but then not being told of their infection. And this isn't just my father or a few people. This is almost everybody. There are significant delays of at least months, sometimes years, and in some cases, actually decades. There are some people who were infected in the 70s and 80s, with, for example, hepatitis C, which is the progression of hepatitis C is slower than HIV generally, in the sense of it. Hepatitis C is a virus which damages the liver. And over time, that leads to cirrhosis, liver cancer, a whole myriad of horrible things that will kill you in time. And so there are many people who were infected with hepatitis C, who then were not told into the 90s, some in the 2000s. And that's despite the fact that every bottle of Factor VIII was infected with hepatitis C, every single bottle. There was no avoiding it. If you use that product, you were getting hepatitis C.
I don't want to make it too personal or upsetting for you, but I'm sure a lot of people will want to know more about your dad. I mean, you say he, if you don't mind talking about him, I mean, you obviously were very young.
Yeah.
So you say he caught it in 84, 85?
So he first tested positive for HIV in 1984, but for hepatitis C, that would have been the first time he was ever given a factor VIII product, which was in 1976. So that was the year in which my dad was moved from cryo, the previous treatment, onto factor VIII concentrate. And that was an American product, the first product he had.
Sounds like there was a cover-up here. I mean, you talk, I think, in a documentary you made about documents being destroyed. So, I mean, people knew, as you say, the risk. They didn't warn patients of what was happening. And it seems to me that they began to try and disguise their involvement as things went on. Is that correct?
Well, the problem was, you know, this was a global event. There were 10,000 people in America who were infected with HIV through these products. People were infected in France, in Japan, in Canada, around the world. And what happened was in the early 90s, you know, I think in the late 80s, as people began to be finding out they were infected, they were just dealing with the gravity of that. And then into the very late 80s, into the 90s, the anger kind of really took hold then, as people began to die in large numbers. And so what you saw, for example, was in France, there were criminal prosecutions of specific doctors, health officials, even the prime minister, the ex-prime minister, Laurent Fabius, at one point, it looked like he may go to prison. In Japan, there were criminal prosecutions. There was a process of the pharmaceutical executives. It's a cultural tradition in Japan where if someone is deeply wronged, there was this process of the pharmaceutical executives bowing down in front of the families, begging for mercy. And there's videotape of that out there. There were criminal investigations in Canada. In the UK, none of that was happening, but clearly we were aware of that. And a number of interesting things happened during that time. Firstly, by the late 80s, the Department of Health in Britain knew that everyone who had used factor VIII had been infected with hepatitis C. Not all had been infected with HIV. It was between a third and a quarter of the haemophiliacs in the country had been infected with HIV, but all who used factor VIII had been infected with hepatitis C. People had begun to be told about HIV, but not hepatitis C. And so what happened was, in 1990, when people had tried to sue the government for being infected with HIV, there had been a settlement offer announced by the government, by John Major. And this was in November of 1990, December of 1990. And on average, people were given around £23,000-£24,000. And they were told, if you don't accept this offer, no one's going to get anything. So people felt deeply pressured into taking what was felt to be a very unjust situation. They hadn't been consulted on the settlement before it was announced to Parliament. There was a lot wrong with that settlement. But the bit I'm getting to is a condition of getting that money for being infected with HIV, small sum though it was bolted on at the last hour. Sign here, you will not be able to sue for hepatitis viruses. And at the time, no one really paid attention to that because, as far as they were concerned, they'd been infected with HIV. From listening to victims' evidence, it was just not seen as anything, really. People just didn't notice it, almost. However, the Department of Health knew everyone signing that had been infected with hepatitis C, bolted that onto the settlement offer, and then after that litigation was settled, it's then in those years following that slowly people are either told they've also been infected with hepatitis C or they find out by seeing it in their medical records. And in fact, some people are just never told and years later happen to have a blood test in hospital for something totally unrelated. And are told, do you know you've got antibodies to hepatitis C? Do you know? And they've got no idea. So that's one element of the cover-up, for sure. And there are plenty of rabbit holes I could go down of where the inquiries looked at missing documents, destroyed documents. Perhaps the biggest scandal when it comes to documents, in my opinion, is that throughout the whole of the 2000s, the government had said and had used this as their reason for saying there shouldn't be a public inquiry. They said all of the documents on this issue are in the public domain or destroyed, and therefore there would be nothing to be learned from a public inquiry. And one of the early things I became involved in campaigning form was examining whether or not that was true.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And what we found out pretty quickly was that it wasn't. And in fact, there were hundreds of files, each file containing hundreds of pages of evidence, both at the National Archives and in a third-party storage provider called Iron Mountain, which the Department of Health used, that had never been put into the public domain, that hadn't been destroyed. And ultimately, exposing that resulted in the still permanent secretary at the Department of Health, Sir Chris Wormald, apologizing to a number of former health ministers for misleading Parliament.
And who are the heroes and villains in this story?
Big question. I mean, for sure, I think in terms of the villains, you know, out of all of this, you know, I can tell you lots and lots of names of people where I feel they made bad decisions, wrong decisions, where they were reckless, where they said the wrong thing to Parliament or to the press or to patients. But ultimately, you know, the pharmaceutical companies actually made money from killing people. And that, I think, really has to be borne in mind, you know, to put it lightly. And I also think the officials who knowingly gave incorrect advice to ministers over the years about what had happened here to prevent there from being an inquiry. I mean, Andy Burnham's been very... So Andy Burnham, now Mayor of Greater Manchester, former health minister, former MP, he's been very clear that during the time he was health minister, he was told repeatedly by officials that no one was ever knowingly given infected blood products. Time and time again. He has seen the evidence. He's become very interested in this area over the years and has, you know, campaigned on our behalf. And he now outwardly says he now knows that to have been a lie, which is correct. The evidence demonstrates it. But it's not just Andy Burnham. It's almost every junior health minister, health secretary there has been where they have raised a question about this issue.
So these are civil servants who are not telling the politicians the truth. And has anyone been held to account for this? And are you hoping after the inquiry...
Maybe that's what the inquiry is for, is it?
Yeah, I mean, so far, no one has been held to account. I know that there are a number of kind of on hold complaints and litigation. So there are complaints at the GMC, the General Medical Council, which oversees the registration of doctors, which are on hold pending the outcome of the inquiry. We've got a group litigation suing the Department of Health, which is on hold pending the outcome of the inquiry. And already the chair of the inquiry, Sir Brian Langstaff, he's been clear that there is going to be criticism that is severe and at scale in the final report. He said that last year, and he's repeated it again just recently this month when the inquiry announced the date of its final report, which is the 20th of May this year. So there is no doubt that this report is not going to be one of those kind of lessons to be learned, but not pointing any fingers kind of reports. He's been pretty clear about what's coming.
And I mean, the problem over now. I mean, no one is getting these infected blood transfusion, blood samples. So it's a historical problem rather than a current problem. Is that right?
So in terms of the infections, nowadays, most of the factor products used in this country are synthetic. Over the years, the factor VIII protein, it was able to be cloned, and there's all kinds of modern technology and processes involved in that are kind of beyond me. But so in terms of blood-borne viral risk, never say never, but it seems as though for those synthetic products, the specific problem of hepatitis C and HIV is over. However, plasma-based factor VIII products are still in use throughout the world, a very small number in this country for people that, for specific reasons, can't have the synthetic products. Ultimately, those products are treated to kill hepatitis or HIV virus, and nowadays donors are tested. However, the real lesson to be learned is it's new and emerging viruses. You know, we knew about hepatitis in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. It was all known about. What wasn't known about in the 50s and 60s was HIV. And this is all part of the story of why these dangerous products were allowed to be kept in use for so long, is that it kind of just became accepted by the pharma companies, the medical profession, and the state that patients were going to be infected with hepatitis through these products. But hepatitis isn't going to completely destroy your liver for maybe 20 or 30 years. So we don't need to worry about that right now. But what they didn't see coming in the 50s and 60s, but arguably should have, is a new supervirus, which in the 80s was HIV. You get HIV the days before treatment, you're going to get AIDS and you will die. It's just a matter of time. There's no real question about it. And so bringing that forward into the context of today, okay, we've dealt with hepatitis and HIV in these products, but it's too easy to get comfortable and think there's never going to be a new super bloodborne virus around the corner.
And is there better regulation now? I mean, is that one of the lessons that was learnt?
I do think there's better regulation now, and I know that in the US, for example, there are better ways of involving the patient advocate community, actually in ways that I don't think we have in this country, to be honest with you. I'm not aware of that same kind of level of patient advocacy involvement, but it's a very difficult area. You know, there are big interests in this, big money is in this industry. I know that, for example, in Canada, there's an organization called Blood Watch, who, although we continue not to pay people to donate blood or plasma in this country, that's not the case everywhere. Paid plasma still happens all throughout the US. And in Canada, as I was just mentioning, there's a battle kind of province to province that's going on, where this organization, Blood Watch, are trying to keep paid plasma operations out of Canada because the lesson should have been learned about that. And some, they've been successful in some places, but the fight goes on in others. So the regulation is better, but it's by no means a complete finished picture, that's for sure.
It seems to me it's a story of kind of two scandals, really. The original scandal of distributing these dangerous products, even though people suspected they were dangerous, indeed knew in terms of hepatitis that they were dangerous. But that, from what you're saying, by the late 80s, that end of the scandal was kind of over. But then there's this 30-odd year extra scandal of people just not wanting to tell the truth, the officials hiding or destroying documents. And I don't actually understand what the motivation for that would be. Just bureaucratic inertia? I don't know.
Cost to compensation.
But in a sense, the people who've lost loved ones, and this, I would say at this point, there's an amazing documentary that you're involved with called In Cold Blood. We'll put a link in the bio. And it includes some incredibly heartbreaking stories of people who lost their loved ones to this. But, you know, having gone through that, then to have to face this kind of like opaque miasma of officialdom for 30-odd years.
What are you hoping for from the report and the inquiry? I mean, your ideal bucket list.
Well, I mean, yeah. First of all, families have been devastated by what happened. I think there isn't the level of understanding in the public about the true damage that was exacted upon people and their families in this scandal. You know, you're talking about, because haemophilia is hereditary, you're talking about families where, you know, there are parents who 2-3 of their children died of AIDS when their kids were 8, 9, 10 years old. There are, you know, just countless stories that there's someone, you know, who I've got to know recently. Their dad was infected through the Factor VIII products, infected the mother. The mother is then pregnant with this person's sister, all infected because the mother infects the daughter while pregnant, and all died from AIDS by the time this person was 3 years old. We have someone else who both of their parents died of AIDS in the same week when they were 9 years old. And so, you know, the impacts of this are just devastating. And in terms of, you know, it's very difficult, you know, the answer as to what does possible justice look like. I mean, clearly one element of that is compensation. And, you know, coming back to, you know, I think you nailed it. Why was this covered up for so long? The cost must have been a consideration. Again, I know Andy Burnham and other former health ministers believe that to be the case. Because of the level of damage and loss you're talking about here, that some of which I've just described, you're talking about people that not only lost their business or their job, you're talking about people who could no longer get health insurance or life insurance because of what they're infected with, that lost their homes, that couldn't ever have a career again, couldn't have had the education that they would have had, could no longer have children, whose wives left them because of what they're infected with. You know, I could go on and on with the kinds of horrible things that, you know.
Well, I mean, it is. Happens. There's a scene in the film which will stay with me forever. A couple who, I think it's the mother saying, you know, if I'd injected my child with poison, I would have gone to prison, quite rightly, for that. But the state did that and then didn't tell the truth about it. When it's stated so boldly like that, you think, Christ.
Yeah, how you live with it.
Did other countries deal with it in different ways? I mean, are they all equally guilty? I mean, have there been inquiries? Or is Britain particularly bad at the way it dealt with it?
There were different investigations at different times. So in the mid-90s, the US did hold an investigation through the Institute of Medicines there. And it was actually published as a book. There's a report online. It's called HIV and the Blood Supply that looked at this question. I think many people felt that didn't go far enough, but it did provide some answers to people. I think quite a few of the countries, obviously I talked about Japan and France, you know, were much quicker to get people in court and to provide compensation. I think what happened in Japan was probably quite a good approach to the compensation question, in the sense that what happened there was the government made a significant compensation payment. I think it was around $500,000 at the time, you know, in the 90s, to each victim or their family. But 50% of that was, they basically forced the pharma companies to cover 50% of that cost because of their role in it. And I think, you know, that in itself is an interesting question, because I know, you know, with the post office scandal that's obviously been in the news a lot recently, there's the question about Fujitsu. And I think also in our scandal, there's that question about, should the government attempt to claw back some of this compensation from these, you know, they are huge companies, you know, we're talking about Bayer, Revlon Healthcare, you know, companies that had and have to this day Baxter Healthcare, huge resources. But I think many people would be skeptical about whether or not a government would really be willing to do that with such huge corporations. I'm just not sure.
And well, this is something the European Union could work on. I mean, that you know, they could use their power to put pressure on the companies, or indeed on governments.
I mean, that's a very interesting prospect. I know that in Italy there have been fairly recent litigations in this area, and I know there's been some compensation there. In Germany, there was some compensation from the pharmaceutical companies. But then there are other countries in Europe that are actually extremely interesting to look at. The one in particular I would point to is Finland. Now, what happened in Finland was, in the early 70s, when Factor VIII comes on the market, Finland says, no, these products are dangerous, we're going to stick with cryo. And they do. And as a result, in Finland, they only ever had two people with haemophilia who were infected with HIV, whereas in this country, we had 1,250. And so you can see right there a clear, real-life, actual example of what could have been had we have made
difference. You said it earlier, the precautionary principle. There it was at play, but not here.
I mean, the World Health Organization, isn't there a role for them in this?
Well, I mean, I'd like to think so, but to be quite honest, I don't think we've really heard anything from them. I mean, I mentioned the 1953 World Health Organization warning, but they also did provide other warnings during the material time, asking countries to take certain precautions. There was one in particular that came through from, I believe, the Council of Europe. And this said, and this was in the early 80s, they issued a recommendation to member countries saying that they should do a number of things in relation to this issue. And those things were, A, inform people taking Factor VIII products of their risks, particularly in the context of AIDS. B, avoid the importation of Factor VIII products. And C was in relation to achieving self-sufficiency. So basically, if you're going to use these products, make sure you're able to produce them in your own country. Of which we did none of those things. And in fact, one of the particularly grievous things that's come out of the inquiry in relation to that first point, which was informing people of the risks of Factor VIII, not only did we not inform people of the risks of Factor VIII, we've seen in the documents that the civil servant who was dealing with that, when he conveyed that recommendation to the health minister at the time responsible, which was Simon Glenarthur, he said that the recommendation said that people should be reassured of the product safety, but the recommendation actually said they should be informed of the risks. And I think that is just one little facet that we've learned from the inquiry that shows how is it that these warnings could be being given to the UK, yet ministers are then saying, carry on using the products, everything's fine. That provides one answer. And so a lot of the blame in this story, I believe, does rest with officials within the civil service. It does raise the question, is it incompetence? Is there something more malicious that was going on? And those are questions which I hope the inquiry will answer in May as well.
Well, we really
have the journalists. We hope you'll come back then, but final question. Have the journalists been pursuing this in the way that they did with the post office scandal? And has the post office scandal encouraged journalists to look at this as another major scandal?
Yeah, I think ever since the post office program really kind of projected that scandal more into the media recently, we've certainly seen a lot more interest from the media, and you know, we were often asked for our thoughts on coverage and to do interviews when that was going on last month. So it has picked up. Now, I think over the years there have been, you know, a lot of journalists that have looked at this subject, you know, whether that be, you know, now for instance, Kaya at the Times has been great, Kaya Burgess, Haroon Sadiq at the Guardian. He's been great. I worked very closely with Sophie Borland and Ben Spencer at the Mail back in 2017 on a couple of stories there. Caroline Wheeler at the Times has been great. Kara Googan at the Telegraph. I could go on and on with lots of names and people that have covered this. But I think until maybe at least the 2000s, the 2010s, much of the reporting was focused on, and I don't say this is wrong, but on the tragedy of what had happened as opposed to the scandal of what had happened. And I think one of the things I've learned in my journey through this is that the hard truth is that governments of all parties are rarely moved to compensate by a moral case, and often they will only look at the question of compensation when they feel there is a legal liability or a good chance of a legal liability.
Or public pressure.
I think that side of it, you know, really was a key factor. But look, coming back to the post office thing, the fact that they're scandal has received all that attention has only been a good thing for our campaign. And look, there's a lot of interest. I'm hopeful that through the inquiry's final report and through further media projects that we will be able to increase, you know, the public understanding of what really happened.
Well, we'll certainly share that documentary that you sent to us, which was, I found, very powerful indeed.
And I hope you'll come back after the report.
Yeah,
I
mean, please
do. Absolutely fascinating. I think it's a story few people know about, but they should be aware.
Congratulations. I mean, all the years you put into this, I know it's not something you've gained any pleasure from, but I hope it gives you some satisfaction at least in the end.
Well, no, thank you very much. And through doing this work, it has given me, you know, that I guess I've seen that when lots of people come together around an issue, that actually the ordinary person can make progress in Parliament. And I think as tough as it's been and as tough as the road may be ahead, I think we will get the truth. And I think there will be some form of justice for people as well. But thank you both as well.
No, look, many, many thanks. All the best and the best of luck in the weeks to come. Yep.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Cheers, Jess.
Thanks.
What an impressive man.
Yes. No, he's very articulate and, I mean, very shocking, really. You know, the fight that's had to go on.
Yeah, and he obviously didn't want to be drawn too much about his own personal family experiences, which I completely understand. But, you know, he's dedicated his best part of his life to this cause. Well, let's hope it really comes to an end soon.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's sad that it requires this sort of commitment to get anything to happen.
All right. Well, turning to the future, we had a bit of a planning conference, Andrew and I, yesterday. So we have some interesting things to talk about. Sport.
Yep.
We haven't done sport yet, have we?
No.
A special sports edition, which is going to include snooker, a sport that's barely known in America, I think. Tell me if I'm wrong. But it's huge in Britain, and actually, more importantly, huge in China, which is what our story is about. But we might combine that with something else sporting, which will leave us a tantalizing secret. What else did we agree to do? Oh, we spoke to Andrew's friend, you should say Richard Norton Taylor.
Richard Norton Taylor, who's a very well-known investigative journalist here, who's done a lot of work on secrecy in Whitehall, intelligence services, cover-ups to do with wars. And so we'll be talking to him, and as a playwright too, who's written about a number of scandals. So I think I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, his play about the Grenfell Tower disaster genuinely moved the dial, didn't it? Because Michael Gove, who's a rather powerful cabinet minister here, went to the play and was really moved by it. And things started to happen. I mean, it's not a happy story, that, by any means, but at least it's one where things might actually, you know, compensation and changes to the law might actually be accelerated by Richard's work.
Yeah. Yes, it's a good case where, you know, individuals can make a difference. And then we're looking at a wartime mystery, the appearance of Rudolf Hess in
I love
Britain.
That story.
I've done about 4 books on it with authors, but always slightly different explanations.
Why is it? It's one of those that just, I think it's because there was this sense that the war might have ended then. Is that partly it?
Yes. Well, I mean, it goes back to, you know, whether this whole question of peace negotiations, which we do know continued throughout the war, not just in 1940. I think the idea that, the history of the war could have been very different. And, of course, Hess, you know, lived on into quite recent times. And big controversy about whether that was the real Hess, whether he was tricked in the way he came here, whether he was just a madman. And the fact that so many of the papers have disappeared, I think, has just added to the mystery.
And, of course, one of your favourite subjects, the level of Nazi sympathy at the higher reaches of the British aristocracy at that time.
Yes, absolutely. And John Harris, who's written a number of books on Hess's flight, has looked at it in great technical detail. And I think there'll be some interesting, I've read his book. I think he'll have some very interesting disclosures. He certainly moved the dial on the story.
So that we have the European royals, which was a suggestion from one of the listeners. We're going to be looking at some European royal scandals. I'm looking forward to that. And then we might be hiding behind the sofa again, because we're talking to Hannah Barnes in mid-April about her really much acclaimed book on the Tavistock scandal of, well, puberty blockers and other things. And that takes us into a very, very contentious area of children and trans rights and the correct medical approach to that subject. But Hannah's a really impressive woman and journalist with a lot of support from all sides, actually, of that debate. So that'll be really interesting.
Yeah, and we're hoping to have Lady C back to talk about her new book on Harry and Meghan.
We are.
Which is always
good. No gossip allowed, though, on that one. Definitely.
No, we'll just keep it very much to the facts. And we've got lots of other ideas, haven't we, that we wanted to explore. I mean, about the whole question of democracy in Britain and the House of Lords and monies being paid to government parties, whether they should have government funding or rely on raising money from donors.
I was thinking, I haven't actually even mentioned this to you, but, you know, when the election comes up, nobody knows, because Britain's a weird country. There's no fixed dates for elections, so the government can choose any time between now and January, I think it is, of next year. Yeah. When it happens, though, we could do a few specials, maybe, with politicians about the things that, you know, you're obsessed with. Freedom of information and secrecy, and whether, you know, which parties might actually change things.
Yes, no, I agree. And dealing with some of these scandals, you know, are they going to actually, you know, pay compensation, or are they going to just kick the ball down the road, as they seem to be doing?
Perhaps we should arrange a big public meeting at Westminster Hall. Scandal mongers interrogate the leading
Yes, we have a special radio program that goes out.
Oh, we could, you know. I think we might actually be able to attract quite a crowd. And that is the time of the electoral cycle when politicians will come talk to anybody to try and win a few votes.
Yes, that's true. Yes, well, we might look at that. Right. And I'm very keen to look at a sort of murder in France in the 1950s of a man called Drummond, which is a book coming out on that, which we haven't discussed, but I think would make a wonderful story. And the whole series of different people have been put forward as the person who murdered Drummond, his wife and young child.
Well, the Harry Oakes story, which I was a little bit, I thought that was a bit marginal, to be honest, but Andrew wanted to do it, so I went along with it. And guess what? It's done really well. People really enjoyed that interview we did with the American guy, the expert on fingerprints.
Yeah. Well, I think people are fascinated by some true crime and these unexplained, you know, murders. So, and I'm very also interested in the Deep Cut, which was a camp for soldiers where a number of soldiers committed suicide and there was a big cover up. And that's a case that's been running for years. I think that would be an interesting thing to look at. But again, interested to hear what people think.
We are always interested to hear what people think, even the angry comments on our YouTube channel. But
yeah,
they weren't all angry last week, actually. A lot of people were very kind. Lovely. Well, there we are. We still have the appetite for the fight. And we will be back soon with more scandals.
Until then.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.